government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast call for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is about quote-unquote net neutrality, that is, a Federal Communications Commission, FCC, content non-discrimination regulatory standard for internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon. You may know that the FCC is set to vote on repealing the net neutrality rules that require internet service providers to treat all web traffic equally. The vote happens tomorrow. The move is spearheaded by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, who has said that repeal will promote a free and open internet. The move, however, comes with significant criticism from net neutrality activists. I'm very pleased to say that we have a tech policy scholar joining us today to help us sort this all out. Our Free Lunch Podcast guest is Brent Skorup. Brent is a research fellow in the Technology Policy Program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. His research topics include wireless policy, new media regulation, transportation technology, and telecommunications. Brent is also a member of the RTP's Cyber and Privacy Working Group. If you'd like to learn more about Brent or the Cyber and Privacy Working Group, please visit regproject.org. Shortly, I'll turn the floor over to Brent. Before I do, I remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore, all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Also, Brent's agreed to take questions after his remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the question and answer period. Brent, it's a pleasure to welcome you today to the 14th episode of the Free Lunch podcast. You have the floor, sir.
Devin, thank you. And I just want to thank Devin and the RTP and everyone listening. I want to thank you for having me on. It's a very timely topic, net neutrality. As many people have probably gathered from news media and from Facebook feeds and Twitter, there's a big vote at the Federal Communications Commission tomorrow. It looks like the three Republican commissioners will vote to reclassify internet access as a lightly regulated Title I service, and which will undo the 2015 order from the Obama FCC to classify internet access as a Title II telecommunications service. These are titles under the Communications Act. And as part of that, they'll vote to undo the so-called net neutrality regulations that have been around for several years. It's always hard to talk about net neutrality because it's a fairly fuzzy term when you try to put pen down to paper. But it is, as Devin said, generally described as a non-discrimination norm for internet service providers regarding internet content. And kind of the core net neutrality protection is that internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, T-Mobile should not block content online, and with some narrow exceptions. This has been a very heated topic for over a decade, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of net neutrality and this movement. And like a lot of movements, there's different motivations for folks. I think for your average consumer who's concerned about net neutrality and advocating net neutrality, they're concerned about any competitive behavior by internet service providers. And but I'm going to speak a little more about what kind of the legal academy and kind of the most savvy activists who have been in this for a while, what they're concerned about, and what that is the question: should the Federal Communications Commission be able to shape what the internet and the internet technologies look like, and will the internet, and this has been going on for 20 years, will the internet, this powerful new medium and distributive media, will this escape FCC oversight and be governed by Federal Trade Commission, kind of generally applicable competition laws and consumer protection laws, or should the FCC, our media regulator, have a role to play in this? And I actually saw Tim Wu is the founder of Net Neutrality. He wrote a paper in 2002, 2003, inventing it and giving it a name. And he tweeted yesterday that Chairman Pai, the current Republican chairman at the FCC, Pai is attacking, this is a quote, Pai is attacking not just net neutrality, but the legacy of the New Deal, of which the FCC is the byproduct. Private power must know some limits. And so I think that touches on what this debate is about. It's about the role of government for this powerful new medium of the internet, which and there's been this fight for decades about whether and to what extent media distributors should be regulated. And there's been this fight about the First Amendment and how protected media distributors are. And this is one reason this is a major reason I support what the Republican commissioners have proposed and will vote on tomorrow is to take their hands off the internet and let consumers and engineers and the marketplace determine what the internet ultimately looks like and how it evolves. And that my view is the FCC should not have a role in that, particularly given its history of media regulation where things tend to get out of control. When you speak to net neutrality activists, a lot of the top advocates come out of the media access movement, which was very focused on this role. What role does the FCC have to play in media distribution? And as a result, broadcast TV, for instance, the FCC can revoke licenses from broadcast radio and TV stations that don't comply with FCC content requirements. Cable TV also has diminished First Amendment rights. If you know the Turner cases in the 90s, Supreme Court said Congress can require certain content on cable TV. And so in the 90s, when the internet was commercialized, there was these two legal schools about will the internet be with cable TV and broadcast and have diminished First Amendment rights, or will it be like print media and newspapers and have full First Amendment rights? And the Supreme Court answered this in 1997. Congress passed the Communications Decency Act, which regulated indecency online. And the Supreme Court, in the Reno versus ACLU case, said that the internet receives full First Amendment protections. There's strict scrutiny for content regulations online. And this is also Congress's view. So Congress was not silent about the internet and internet regulation in the 90s when the internet was just getting started. They passed they codified into statute a U.S. policy, which is I'm quoting, to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal or state regulation. And it's this key line, unfettered by federal or state regulation, that is that the current FCC is relying on for its decision to undo the 2015 regulations and the 2015 classification of broadband internet access as a telecommunications service, where there's a bunch of regulations that kick in. So that's some of the background, and I'll speak about just how NetInshalla came about and started to gain kind of public traction. In 2002, the Bush FCC, chaired by Michael Pollan at the time, was faced with a novel legal question, kind of an unanticipated legal question. So internet access until then was mostly on phone lines. So you'd have DSL or dial-up internet access, and telephone lines had legacy Title II telecommunications restrictions on them. And the Clinton FCC said basically there are two services to consumers when they access the internet. There's the internet access component, which we're not going to regulate, and there's the telecommunications component, which we are going to regulate as we have in the past. When cable providers around 2000 started offering internet access, this was a new problem because cable had never been regulated under Title II, and the Bush FCC at the time said we're not going to say there are these two services being offered to consumers. There's one integrated service being offered to consumers, and that's internet access, which is not regulated, and therefore we're not going to regulate cable similar to the telephone internet access. This is about this time that Tim Wu wrote his paper about network neutrality. It was a response to the idea that the internet was going to escape FCC regulation, and that's when it started. And the Chairman Powell's decision to not regulate cable internet was appealed to the Ninth Circuit and all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in the Brand X case, in a 6-3 decision, said that it was a reasonable interpretation of the law to classify internet access as a single integrated service, and for the FCC not to regulate that cable modem service. And they use what's called Chevron deference, this idea that agencies, if it's a reasonable interpretation of the law, courts will not impose their views of what a better interpretation is. It's a very differential standard, and it comes into play in future net neutrality cases. So, but at the time, Chairman Powell in 2005 released a policy statement of the FCC that looked a lot like net neutrality norms, just that consumers should have free access to all online content and devices of their choosing. But there was a change. There was a new chairman, new Republican chairman, Kevin Martin, came in 2007, tried to enforce that policy statement against Comcast. Comcast, at the time, there was a dispute with BitTorrent. BitTorrent, at the time, was a torrenting technology that consumed a lot of bandwidth, and Comcast was trying to preserve other services and used a clumsy mechanism to manage their network. Kevin Martin, the chairman of the FCC at the time, tried to enforce the 2005 net neutrality open network policy statement against Comcast, and by the way, BitTorrent and Comcast had already settled their differences. Actually, BitTorrent worked for a couple years on developing a protocol that was more polite user of the network. So it was early net neutrality activists who asked for FCC intervention, and so Kevin Martin and the FCC intervened. Comcast sued the FCC on different grounds, but ultimately in 2010, the D.C. Circuit said that the FCC could not enforce this policy statement, and also could not use the FCC then was pointing to congressional policy statements as authority, and the D.C. Circuit said the FCC can't use congressional policy statements as authority to assert their jurisdiction over internet access. And so in 2010, that was the first time these net neutrality norms were struck down by a court. Now the Obama administration was in office when these rules were struck down, and Chairman Jenkowski decided to try again at net neutrality protections, and And the rules at that time were essentially no blocking, no throttling. Those were the central rules. And so they didn't classify internet access as a telecommunications service. They kept it as a lightly regulated Title I service, not a Title II service. But this was a problem for the court, so they passed these rules in 2010. Verizon sued against these rules, and the D.C. Circuit again struck down the attempt at net neutrality regulations. They said you can't impose common carrier regulations on non-common carriers, and no blocking, no throttling sounds a lot like common carrier regulations. And so once again, it was tossed back to the Obama FCC, and once again, there was a new chairman, Chairman Tom Wheeler, in what was at the FCC in 2014, and they were looking for a so-called hybrid model of regulating net neutrality, but then political interventions changed the course of that proceeding. Chairman Wheeler was resistant to use Title II for various reasons. But in 2014, after a tough Senate election for Senate Democrats, as one net neutrality proponent tells it, the Obama administration, the Obama White House, wanted to send a signal, send a political win to progressives, and so came out with a YouTube video that was offered to everyone on YouTube. President Obama encouraged the FCC to use Title II to classify internet access and impose common carriage regulations on internet access providers. And literally overnight, the FCC, which was in the middle of proceeding in late 2014, had to reverse course and find a reason to classify internet access as a Title II telecommunications service. And so in 2015, they classified what they call broadband internet access service, or BIAS, service as a Title II telecommunications service. Again, I want to reemphasize, until 2015, internet access service was a Title I lightly regulated service, and that had been consistent since at least 1996. And then 2015, this was reversed. Internet access became a heavily regulated Title II service. Title II is the most powerful regulatory tool the FCC has available. It was designed in the 1930s for the AT&T long-distance monopoly. And so this was very controversial in 2015, to classify internet access as a telecommunications service. Michael Powell, who had moved on to the NCTA, the Cable Association, called it World War III, and that's what it was. This was a very controversial decision. Again, it's about should the FCC have a role in the evolution of the internet, or should this be left to the Federal Trade Commission and competition laws? And Tim Wu, about this time, there was the scholar who coined the term net neutrality. He was in front of Congress, and there were questions. Can't competition law solve a lot of these issues that people are concerned about? And his response was something along the lines of the FCC needs that authority so that it can shape media and culture and the democratic process. And so this is a sweeping view of net neutrality that I don't think every person who's concerned about it shares. This is mostly the view of kind of the legal academy and the folks at the top who have advocated for net neutrality for a long time. And so that brings us to today. So the 2015 order and rules came down. It was World War III as far as the industry was concerned, and those on the free market side, like myself, opposed. And so there was litigation in 2016. Again, it went to the D.C. Circuit, and relying on Chevron deference, so there are many legal challenges to the order, including First Amendment challenges, which I'll talk about in a moment. But the D.C. Circuit in 2016, in a 2-1 decision, upheld the Title II classification of broadband internet access service, and it's just very deferential to the agency. in a few months ago, in 2017, the full en banc panel at the D.C. Circuit denied rehearing of the case. And although there were dissents from Judge Kavanaugh and Brown, including on the First Amendment issues, and right now there is a pending cert petition before the Supreme Court against the 2015 rules. That's Dan Berninger versus FCC. And there are also industry petitions against the 2015 order. These are likely to be mooted once the FCC votes tomorrow. If they vote to repeal the 2015 order and rescind it, then the Supreme Court petitions may be mooted. We'll see. There's a small chance the Supreme Court will take it up. But so that's the situation as it is now. And you know, on the First Amendment question, which I think is particularly interesting, in 2016, the litigation against the 2015 order revealed some of the severe weaknesses of the 2015 rules. As I said at the beginning, net neutrality, the core policy of net neutrality is that internet service providers can't block content. Unfortunately for the FCC, there were severe First Amendment problems with requiring all ISPs to transmit all content. Internet service providers are clearly First Amendment speakers. The Obama FCC didn't dispute this during litigation, and were really pressed on the First Amendment arguments. And what became clear, the Obama FCC essentially bifurcated the internet into this regulated service, broadband internet access service, BIAS service, and non-BIAS services. And what they said was, BIAS service is essentially tautology. If it looks like a telecommunications service, if it's offered as a telecommunications service, it is a telecommunications service. But if an ISP blocks content, which they are free to do, they are no longer in the Title II category. They drop out of Title II into the non-BIAS service. And so this is probably the most common misconception about the 2015 rules, that it prevents ISPs from blocking content. It simply does not prevent ISPs from blocking content. ISPs are allowed to block content, and there's a few reasons for this. It's just, you know, they're First Amendment speakers. There's also a statute that allows internet service providers to block offensive content like pornography, and so this posed a big problem for net neutrality norms. And the order is much more limited as far as the rules are concerned. The issue has always been that Title II comes with all this regulatory baggage. The FCC has forbearance authority from Congress, so the Wheeler FCC in 2015 forbore from a lot of the Title II baggage. But there's a lot that remains, and certainly that doesn't bind future FCCs. And what folks on the free market side, and what Chairman Pai has singled out there are three bright line rules for the 2015 rules, so-called bright line rules. But really, those you can pretty much ignore, in my view. That the only rule that matters is the so-called Internet Conduct Standard, which is so broad and sweeping that it captures all the other rules, and roughly, it says that internet service providers cannot unreasonably interfere with, unreasonably disadvantage online content applications. No one's quite sure what that means. Chairman Wheeler at the time was asked what that means and said, you know, we'll find out. He said he didn't know what it meant. And so that's the real problem from a policy perspective, is that internet conduct standard, which companies don't know what it means, and it can be used at any time for the various technologies that ISPs and web companies are deploying. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I certainly welcome what the FCC is prepared to do tomorrow, and to rescind the 2015 order and restore that Title I classification that existed from 1996 until 2015 of internet access. And And I think with that, I'll open up to questions. I covered a lot there, and certainly if anyone wants clarification or has questions, happy to answer them.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Brent. So we are going to go to the Q&A now. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt. That prompt will indicate that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, all you need to do to request the floor is enter the star button and the pound button on your telephone keypad. I'm going to open the floor. Okay, the floor mode is on. Again, if you'd like to request the floor to ask Brent a question, enter star and then the pound button. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order that they're received. Brent, I'd like to ask the first question, if I can. You mentioned the courts several times. They've weighed in on net neutrality rules. It's your prediction that tomorrow the vote to repeal net neutrality will go 3-2 in favor of repeal, these net neutrality rules, and rolling back to Title I. What are the prospects in your mind that this repeal vote is going to be upheld in court? I mean, it no doubt will be challenged.
Yeah, thanks, Devin. So, you never know what courts will do, but I would be stunned if they struck down this the order that looks like it'll be passed tomorrow. On the core question, which is classifying internet access as an information service, that's the core question, and the Supreme Court has already weighed in on this in 2005 in the Brand X case that I mentioned. When the Powell FCC classified cable modem service as an internet access or as an information service. So on that core question, can the FCC classify internet access as an information service? The Supreme Court has already weighed in a 6-3 decision, said yes, that's within the FCC's purview and judgment to do that. So, never say never, but I would be given the deference that the agencies, and particularly the Supreme Court, has shown on this question, I would be stunned if it were overturned.
I see. Well, thanks, Brent. We've got our first question here, so we're going to go to that question. Anyone else who's on the line who has a question, you can join the queue by hitting star and pound on your keypad. Hello, caller? You have a question? I think that might have been retracted, Brent. Are you still there, Brent?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, good. If you have a question, enter star and then pound on your keypad. Seeing no questions right now, I'd like to make an announcement for everyone on the call to please mark your calendars. Next week, the RTP will host two free lunch podcast teleforums. On Monday, December 8th, we will discuss regulatory reform at the Department of the Interior with Gary Lawkowski, who's a counselor to the solicitor at DOI. And on Wednesday, December 20th, we'll discuss copyright regulation with IP law professor Mark F. Schultz, Motion Picture Association VP Jennifer L. Pariser, and multiple Grammy Award-winning composer and musician Maria Schneider. So mark your calendars. That's Monday, December 18th, and Wednesday, December 20th at the noon hour. Okay, we've got a couple questions in the queue. Caller, when we get to your question, you can ask your question.
Hi, this is Ken Cuccinelli. I direct the Regulatory Action Center at FreedomWorks Foundation.
Oh, yeah, great.
These days, and I was also one of the AGs that sued in the first round of the litigation, joining Comcast, Verizon, and so forth. Well, we were happy with that outcome anyway. My question for you is, industry and economic. It's two questions, really. The first is, what do you see being the near-term economic changes that may take hold around the internet because of this new rule, assuming it comes out tomorrow? And second of all, longer term, how does this subject and the discussion of it change with the advent, particularly of satellite internet that looks to be coming online with big investors like SoftBank, Elon Musk's group, There's a third one coming online, that, though the other two are probably not going to be as competitive as SoftBank. So how does that change the regulatory discussion?
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks, Ken. So on the economic effects, you know, there's some evidence in the record, and I'm not an economist, so, you know, take my views with a grain of salt, but there is some evidence in the record that industry investment has not been as robust as you would expect, and I believe according to some measures, investment has dropped in the last 2 years while these rules have been in place. There's frankly a lot of uncertainty about what services are available, and I'll give one example of this uncertainty. I mentioned, the core rule is the Internet Conduct Standard. I mean, you can ignore the others because this one is so vague and so open-ended that it captures pretty much anything that ISPs and tech companies do online. For instance, T-Mobile a few years ago started doing this zero rating business model, which they would not, it was called Binge On, they would not detract from your monthly data limit when you use certain services like YouTube or Hulu or streaming services. So this is fairly controversial for net neutrality activists. And Chairman Wheeler, who created the rules, was asked what he thought of this zero rating plan, and he said it was competitive and innovative. Another Title II supporter, Susan Crawford, who's a prominent supporter, has written publicly quite the opposite, that this violates the rules. She called it a human rights infringement to use this zero rating business model. And so that's two people who support Title II in the same rules. They're reading the same regulations, and one says it's competitive, and one says it's a human rights infringement. And this is not, I mean, this is a prominent scholar in this movement. So, that's a lot of uncertainty for companies. Their services could be competitive or a human rights infringement, and it's somewhere on the spectrum. I'll note T-Mobile and YouTube were working on in 2014 what's called TCP proxy bypass. They were experimenting with this, and the long and short of it is it improved YouTube streaming on mobile devices and improved battery life. But once the 2015 rules came about, they weren't sure it was legal what they were doing anymore, and they stopped doing it. And you would expect these small experiments to, over years, accumulate and depress investment and innovation in new services. One last one is Facebook Free Basics. Washington Post reported a couple years ago, Free Basics is again one of these. It's basically a curated internet. You have free access to certain websites and content and applications, and it's all around the world. And Free Basics, Facebook approached the White House, the Obama White House, about deploying in the U.S. They were going to work with small wireless providers to fill a niche market need, and they must not have got the answer they wanted. Free Basics is still not available in the U.S. Perhaps that will change now that the rules will be repealed. So that's the economic question. On the satellite, I would expect when you have more competitors, whether satellite or mobile, I mean, a lot of people are cutting their wireline broadband service and going entirely mobile using a smartphone or a hotspot. And this will only grow. And I think this will take a lot of the momentum out of the net neutrality movement. When you have more competition and consumers are feeling better treated and feeling like they're getting a better deal, I think a lot of the consumer interest in this movement will decline. And so I think it's encouraging that satellite broadband providers and wireless providers and fixed wireless providers are deploying more readily, and hopefully with repeal of these rules, they can do more business models that would have been questionable under the 2015 rules.
Well, thank you for the question, and also thank you for the answer. We're going to go to our next question here, but if anyone else would like to ask a question, enter star and the pound button, we'll put you in the queue.
Hello, I'm Andrew Drew Hume. I am a lay member of the Federalist Society, and just I'd like to ask, as a consumer, what's the parade of horribles that was allegedly going on in 2014 that was hurting me that, because of the 2015 change, is now no longer hurting me? And I've just been unable to find anybody who's been able to give me a good example of how I was being harmed in 2014 and no longer am in 2017. And I'm hoping you can clarify that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're touching on a critical point. And there are some cases, and part of the problem is net neutrality, defining net neutrality is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's a very amorphous concept, and so it's not quite clear what it prohibits and what it doesn't. But you know, some of these, there's been a handful of so-called net neutrality violations. There was the Comcast BitTorrent case, which I mentioned, which was basically a clumsy attempt at Comcast managing their network, where the FCC intervened. But in that case, the industry settled it themselves, and BitTorrent, as I mentioned, worked on a protocol that was more polite to other online services. And so that's not a great example, although it's often put forward.
Well, precisely. So how was I being harmed? Nobody has been able to at least convince me that I was being harmed.
Right. And Chairman Pai has said, you know, net neutrality is a solution for a problem that, how does he put it? It's a solution looking for a problem. And I think a lot of these harms are hypothetical or possibly in the future. It's a good question. And you would expect, I mean, the internet is a new technology. I mean, certainly there's going to be growing pains, and there have been some disputes over the years, but you would expect it. I mean, it's really remarkable the internet works as well as it does. It's this global network of 30,000 interconnecting networks that often exchange traffic on a handshake basis. And, you know, it's remarkable it works as well as it does. Certainly there will be disputes. And my preference, you know, is that we'll use light touch regulation and just generally applicable competition consumer protection laws. That's adequate in my view.
Thank you, Brent, and thank you, caller, for that question. It's always nice to have callers who are quote-unquote lay people participating in Federalist Society programs, so thank you for calling in. Brent, I'd like to follow up on something the caller said. With a question. We have a question in the queue, and we're going to get to that. If anyone else has a question, we'll put you in the queue. Just press star and then the pound button. But my question is, what's the effect of this repeal for consumers and for industry?
So I think for consumers, in the immediate term, that there won't be any large differences for consumers in the immediate term. That's just a factor of just how these investment decisions are made and how these technologies are deployed. There's a long development process. In the long term, as I said, there's more certainty that getting rid of the Internet Conduct Standard is key, because I mean that just captures so many potential business models and new technologies that are coming about. Yeah, I should add, the internet is evolving, and in the next few years, it will evolve in ways that it didn't in the past. Christopher Yu at University of Pennsylvania's technologist talks about network diversity and the fact that the internet, it used to be in the 90s about web traffic, and it, you know, over the last 5 or 10 years, the design has changed to accommodate streaming media like Netflix and YouTube and Hulu, and in the next era in the internet will be different types of services and some of which need prioritized service. So mobile technology, LTE technology, for instance, has 9 different levels of priority service built into it. There's anticipation that different services need different quality of service. You want a voice call or a telemedicine call or a teleconferencing a session to be prioritized over once a day backup or a picture upload and that sort of thing. And so I think what we'll see, the internet is getting deeper into our lives, and people talk about the Internet of Things And, you know, we're going to need the ability to change the network and change how the network works. And we can't, I don't know what it will look like, but by restoring Federal Trade Commission authority, where the burden is largely on the Federal Trade Commission to show consumer harm, that gives much more certainty to companies to experiment with new network topologies and technologies.
Thanks, Brent. Okay, so we'll go to our next caller now.
Hi, this is Chris Berger from Lawrence, Kansas, and I'm a lawyer member, but admittedly very ignorant about this and scratch my head all the time because there's so many words being tossed around that seem to be very inflammatory but don't have any meaning to them. So as I see, it seems like the people who own the backbone of the Internet are the ones that were opposed to what took place earlier, but all of the platforms that use, you know, those backbones seem to be in favor of it. Can you share maybe some insight into why that division exists?
Let's see. So I think part of it is just regulatory asymmetry. The 2015 regulations were pretty focused on internet service providers, and in this world where internet service providers feel that, I mean, they're vertically integrated and they're getting into content and these other things, and they feel this would be a disadvantage that only affects them. And it should be said, I mean, you know, I think for your average person who's concerned about, you know, competitive, anti-competitive behavior, you know, in tech markets, we don't anticipate in this way, you know, this parade of horribles. We allow these markets to develop. You know, mobile app stores, you know, there's really two options, and if you can't get on one of those, you know, it would not be good. But you see these similar competitive environments for all sorts of technology companies, and to focus on one aspect of the internet, I think, posed a regulatory asymmetry problem that a lot of ISPs resisted. And tech companies they generally support, I mean, net neutrality norm. I mean, I think everyone supports the norms. On the Title II classification in particular, the tech companies are much more mixed. Eric Schmidt of Google, I mean, kind of famously, Wall Street Journal reported the week the Obama White House was going to push for Title II, he called and kind of discouraged them from going that route because, you know, presumably he didn't know where it would lead. And I think you're seeing that today, where now these net neutrality arguments are being turned on tech companies, particularly, I mean, from Republican politicians as well. And so tech companies, they're of mixed mind on this. A company like Netflix, I think there was a belief, they were one of the few out their voices in support of Title II. I think they thought they could get cheaper interconnection rates from ISPs if there's regulation, but it's really a mix.
Well, it seems like the, you know, the Reddits of the world are screaming that this is the worst thing that could ever happen if it's set aside, but yet, you know, the Comcast on which they rely really need it set aside, or at least pretend that they are. Can you share maybe an insight as to why they view it so differently? I mean, I hear the 30,000 foot view there, but is there something else that is more content oriented?
For your average person, I think they've been persuaded by a lot of the misinformation out there. This idea that, you know, for instance, you know, the biggest myth is that the 2015 rules prevent website blocking, and that's just not the case. This was made clear in litigation. I've raised it. Others have raised, this is one of the talking points for the Republican commissioners right now. The 2015 rules don't prohibit blocking. ISPs don't block. It's just not, you know, within, you know, certain exceptions like pornography for children and that sort of thing. So I think there's a big disconnect between what people think these rules do and what they actually do. And I think the average person also doesn't see the history of regulatory capture that's gone on at the FCC, and that's another concern of mine. it's not clear to me that tech companies will win out in the end at the FCC. It's very plausible or possibly likely that internet service providers will gain the upper hand. And so I think your average Redditor and website operator, they've been hit with all these parade of horribles that the previous caller mentioned, and they think these are plausible or realistic, and they're just not.
Thanks, Brent, and thanks for the question. Okay, we'll go to our next question now. I think there's still more time for questions, so if you do have a question, just press star and pound on your keypad, and we'll get to you in turn.
Hello, hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, hello.
Yes, we can hear you.
Hey, my name is Giovanni Johnson. I'm based out of Dallas, Texas. I guess you could call me a student member of the Federalist Society. So, my question is in regards to what I've seen as so-called worst-case scenarios under a net neutrality-free internet. In the country of Portugal, there are some internet providers, some ISPs are starting to divide the internet into little packages that, for instance, the Lisbon-based Lisbon-based telecommunications firm MEO, they've started rolling out packages that are dividing like basic internet services such as Google, Yahoo, Bing, Blogger, YouTube into like $5 packages, further international websites for an additional $5, news websites for an additional $5. It's sort of an a la carte type of deal. So my question is in regards to whether these business models that seemingly may not be to the complete benefit of the consumer, whether these could be effectively be regulated under the Federal Trade Commission, as Chairman Pai has been saying that they could do.
Yeah, thank you, Giovanni. And this is a common misconception about what the 2015 rules do. They don't prohibit. You're speaking of there's a Portuguese mobile carrier that allows unlimited use of certain applications and websites, in addition to their internet plans. Yeah, and one thing should be, I mean, there's a few things. One, Portugal has net neutrality regulations. They're required by the EU. Every member nation is required to have net neutrality regulations. So Portugal has net neutrality regulations, and again, this gets to the idea, it's not clear what net neutrality means because it apparently permits this sort of thing. And related, in the U.S., those sorts of curated internet packages are permitted under the 2015 rules. They simply are. I mean, it's not the case that they're prohibited. Internet service providers can do that sort of thing. This is made clear in litigation. The D.C. Circuit said ISPs are free to edit the internet in that way. So whether these rules are in place or not, ISPs are free to do that. And for various reasons, it's not very common, but they're free to do that if they see a market for that. And there might be for children and that sort of thing where parents might be nervous about full access to the full internet, and maybe they just want children to have a slice of the internet available to them. So thank you for the question. It's a common misperception about the 2015 rules and about the Portuguese net neutrality regulations.
Yes, thank you for the question, and thanks, Brent. Looks like we've got about 10 minutes left, so if you have any more questions, press star and the pound button, and we'll get those to Brent. Brent, as we wait around for any other questions, are there any final remarks you'd like to make, or anything that we've missed? The questioning's been great.
Yeah, no, the questions have been great. I think the only thing I'll add is that this you know, despite some of the news reports, this will not be a Wild West. It's restoring the Federal Trade Commission as oversight of the internet marketplace, and and competition laws. The FTC has a long history of regulating internet carriers and wireless carriers, and they're actually the premier privacy regulation agency in the U.S. They've brought 500 enforcement actions when it comes to privacy. A lot of net neutrality folks are concerned about privacy abuses. So this will all be restored to the Federal Trade Commission. This is not a Wild West. We have competition laws. We have consumer protection laws, and I'm glad FTC jurisdiction will be restored, and that everyone online, all the internet companies, including Google, Netflix, and ISPs, will be under generally the same rules, so that consumers have some sense of consistency when they're consuming online content.
Well, Brent, I think those final remarks are where we should leave the topic. I don't see any more questions. I'd like to let everyone on the call know that if you're interested in what the Regulatory Transparency Project at the Federal Society is doing, you should go to our website at regproject.org, subscribe to our newsletter, or just follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. On behalf of the Federal Society's RTP, I want to thank our audience and, of course, Brent for joining us on the Free Lunch Podcast today. Hopefully, we'll have you again on Monday, when we have Gary Lawkowski, Counselor to Solicitor, talking about regulatory reform at the Department of Interior. Until then, so long, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.